It is 9:30, because our meetings always start on time. Present today, Representative Chenault, Representative Millet online, Representative Olson, Representative Heron, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Tuck, and Chair Johnson. Representative Hogger has been previously excused. We do have a quorum to conduct business, so please turn off your cell phones. I don't know what we would ask for if something went off in a Rules Committee meeting. It'd be rare. Today before us, we have one bill on the agenda, HB 247, Tax Credits, Interest Refunds, and Oil and Gas. In way of kind of letting everybody know what's going on, this morning we will have a presentation on the committee substitute with Analytica and staff. At that point, we will adjourn and come back tomorrow with any questions, industry testimony, public testimony. We'll then resource for floor session and come back in the evening to try to finish up. So I'd encourage you to have all your amendments and stuff ready tomorrow afternoon. In the way of kind of opening comments, we have significant challenges before us. We have unprecedented in our state's history, and probably any state's history. Everything is on the table. We need to stop writing checks and to oil and gas industry. The resource exploration incentives they've worked. We have Cook Inlet is now energy sufficient. For the first time, we've had a pipeline increase in the flow in the pipeline. And so those credits did work. But under today's situation, I don't think we can continue on. This CES represents significant cuts to future spending. But we also have to recognize that the industry faces those same harsh decisions that we're making on a daily basis. Our fates with the industry are intertwined, and we have to remember that they are our partners. This is not an us versus them conversation. We are in this together. This CES basically phases out tax credit system for some small producers. They create jobs. They find many more resources, and there's still a lot to be done. But what we don't want to do is trim it back so bad that we're not open for business any longer. This CES gives companies a chance to develop new plans and financing structures by phasing out the credits. We cannot, but once again, we cannot sacrifice future oil production for today's budget. So with that, I want to point out that this CS strikes a balance. It's the efforts of many conversations and going back through many of the bills that have been in previous committees, and it is a starting point. For some people, it won't go far enough. For some, it will go too far. But I believe it is a reasonable path forward and a good starting point for us to move forward with some kind of system that allows the state to generate additional revenue while maintaining the opportunity for the our partners to continue to do business. Members, you have the committee substitute in your packet, and can I have a motion to for the committee substitute? I'm not sure. Olson.
I move to adopt committee substitute 29-GH2609/D.
And I will object for the purposes of discussion. With that, Ms. Delbridge. And we also have Janik Mayer from our legislative consultants from Analytica. So, Ms. Delbridge, we'll work through the, you're way, long way down there. We'll work through the bill and the summary. So with that, Ms. Delbridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rena Delbridge. I am staff to Representative Mike Hocker and working with Representative Johnson on this bill. You have before you the D version. Very broadly, this version closes out the state's tax credit program beginning in January 2017 through January 2020, except for one Middle Earth exploration credit that currently sunsets by statute in 2022. In phasing out the credit system on the North Slope, we transition to a method of carrying forward lease expenditures that a business is unable to deduct in the current year. While we're phasing out credits, this enables This enables industry to still have the net profits tax system benefit of carrying forward losses. So statewide, we put a $75 million cap per company in the amount of credits that can be cashed back each year. Refunds from the oil and gas tax credit fund for credits are prioritized to companies that have at least 80% Alaska hire. The CS will require disclosure of some information to the public. The Department of Revenue would make public each year the name of a company receiving refunds for credits from the oil and gas tax credit fund, as well as the total dollars refunded to that company each year. The CS maintains some provisions that have been in a number of previous iterations through the legislative process, including provisions related to outstanding liability, so that the Department of Revenue can withhold the amount of an outstanding liability from a company's refund. It includes a requirement for a $250,000 surety bond and provisions for prioritizing those claims. It includes provisions so that municipal producers need to allocate their lease expenditures to taxable production so that they're not receiving credits for production that is not taxed. The income tax credits that are currently in statute to support the in-state refineries and the LNG storage facilities are maintained in statute and are refundable, but no longer would come out of the oil and gas tax credit fund. The interest rate on delinquent taxes, which includes those undergoing audit, increases from 3 points above the federal discount rate to 5 points and goes from simple interest to compounded quarterly. Something new to this version is a provision that says that the gross tax that the state assesses on private royalties paid to private landowners may never be less than zero. Those are the broad statewide provisions. Specific to Cook Inlet and Middle Earth, the Cook Inlet and Middle Earth credits will end January 1st, 2019. Again, Middle Earth retains that exploration credit through 2022 as currently provided in statute. A legislative working group will work to develop through the interim this year for presentation to the legislature in 2017 a new oil and gas tax regime for Cook Inlet and Middle Earth, with the intent that that takes place in January 2019 after the expiration of all the credits. So for 2016, all the credits currently in statute for Cook Inlet and Middle Earth would continue. This is a 20% qualified capital expenditure credit, a 40% well lease expenditure credit, and the 25% net operating loss credit. Going forward, in order to receive any credits for Cook Inlet work from 2017 on, a company has to have had oil or gas production in Cook Inlet in calendar year 2016. So for 2017, at the end of 2016, the 20% qualified capital expenditure credit would be repealed. Companies would be eligible in 2017 and in 2018 for a reduced 20% well lease expenditure credit, and in 2017 only for a 25% net operating loss credit. Again, the legislative working group will be working on a new oil and gas tax regime to take effect with the expiration of those credits. Specific to Middle Earth, there is an extension of one credit for the Copper River Basin only that currently expires in statute in July of 2016. It extends in the CS to the end of 2016 to provide an opportunity for a company that is in the progress of drilling wells and not quite able to meet those deadlines. So on the North Slope, the one remaining credit after the expiration in July of this year of an exploration credit will be the net operating loss credit of 35%. That credit will remain in statute for the next 3 years, 2017, 2018, and 2019, at 35%, refundable for companies that have less than 50,000 barrels per day. The only way that you can get this three-year transitionary measure is if you have production in the North Slope of less than 15,000 barrels per day in 2016, or if you are not yet in production but you are developing as a unit with an approved plan of development or plan of exploration. After those 3 years, the net operating loss credit expires completely on the North Slope. Meanwhile, we will be shifting to a system of lease carry-forwards, lease expenditure carry-forwards, so that expenses that are not able to be deducted but are still eligible lease expenditures in a current year are carried forward against your liability in a future year. That shift to carry forward of lease expenditures has the effect of hardening the gross minimum tax floor at 4%. Finally, the two more points on the North Slope, the gross value reduction that is received for new oil, that is a timeless benefit under current statute. That benefit will be limited to a 10-year benefit beginning once regular production starts. The CS also explains how this, how oil that it receives a new oil benefit once it graduates and becomes normal oil is treated for tax purposes. And then previous bill versions have all included provisions that would prevent the use of the gross value reduction from amplifying the size of a net operating loss. This CS certainly retains that provision as well. Mr. Chairman, are there questions on the summary, or should I go forward with the sectional?
Any questions? And I do want to recognize Representative Millett is online. And Representative Millett, if you have any questions, just jump in at any time.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Any questions for Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't mind explaining the surety bond again to $250,000, can you give a little bit more detail on how that operates, works?
Of course, Representative Tuck, through the chair. The surety bond provision begins at the very bottom of page 26 of version D and is mostly there on page 27. This was a provision that was added by amendment in House Resources. Following concerns, particularly in the Cook Inlet region over the past year or two, of some companies that have gone into bankruptcy and been unable to basically pay their bills to some local businesses and contractors. And so in exchange for a business license to conduct oil and gas activity, a company would need to file with the Department of Commerce a $250,000 surety bond. And essentially, we list The version D lists what they are promising to pay with that. And then in lines 16 through 31 and on to page 28 lists sort of the order that these claims would be prioritized in. This bond can be waived by the Commissioner of Commerce if they find that the company is producing oil and gas in commercial quantities. So there's an opportunity to have that lifted at some point. The surety bond claims against this would be satisfied, beginning with material, equipment, and supplies delivered in the state, and then go to cover labor, including employee benefits. Finally, taxes and other amounts to cities and boroughs, repair of public facilities, and then finally taxes and other amounts due to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on the minority leader's question, Rena, has this bond been fully vetted? Have we talked to a bankruptcy lawyer? Because maybe it's just a rumor, but I understood that even the $250,000 could get caught up in the bankruptcy claim.
Representative Herron, through the chair, I have not spoken with any bankruptcy attorneys. This provision has been in the bill since House Resources through House Finance. I believe that the Department of Law has likely reviewed this, and certainly the administration may have some additional comments on that provision when they speak with you tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Christopher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rena, the provision that relates to, I guess, was it municipal production, is that being from maybe a different part of the state than most others around this table, does that relate to the, I'm remembering correctly, the Beluga Field and Municipal Light and Power? Are there any other entities in Alaska that would apply to besides MLMP?
Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, my understanding is that it would essentially be limited to Municipal Light and Power, and of course they have ownership at Beluga. A municipal producer like that would produce, and some of their production would go to their own generation, and other production could be sold to other entities for other uses. The provision, and it is in the governor's original bill and certainly has carried through the process. essentially says that if you're a municipality that produces and you're using it for your own generation, you're already not subject to taxes on that portion, and therefore this CS would make it clear that you do not receive credits on that portion. If you sell a portion of your production and it's taxable, in that instance, you can receive credits for that portion of your production.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rena, does that, when you talk reduction, do you mean actual sale of natural gas to some other entity, or could production mean you turn that natural gas to electricity and sell electricity through the wire to someone else? Is there a distinction between those two?
Speaker Chenault, through the chair, there's no distinction in that per se. Essentially, if you're selling your gas to someone else for generation rather than to your own use, then you would have that limitation. In order, you would need to allocate your lease expenditures to receive credits only on the taxable portion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional questions? Representative Herring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rena, lease expenditure deductions. Could you give a few examples of these types of activities?
Representative Herring, through the chair, lease expenditures are currently defined in statute in AS 4355-165. They are, generally speaking, those costs of getting oil or gas out of the ground that are upstream of your point of production. So the cost of actually working in the field and then taking it to the processing facility, as soon as you feed it into a transportation line to go elsewhere, you're past the point of production. Lease expenditures, they have to be upstream, they have to be ordinary and necessary costs for the IRS, and they have to be direct costs. Lease expenditures, there's a very long list in statute of things that are excluded, and we can certainly go over some of those if you would like. They include things like royalties that you pay are not lease expenditures. The costs of acquisitions are not lease expenditures. Lobbying or public relations do not count as lease expenditures. It's a fairly precise itemization. Would you like me to pull that up? And
No, I just wanted some examples on the record, Mr. Chairman.
You need a follow-up?
No, I'm good, thanks.
Any additional questions? Rena, if you'd stay there, I think we will now hear from Janik, Mayor of Analytica. Janik, are you online?
Same plan.
Can I take a brief of these? Trusty staff, thanks. Rena, would you go ahead and go through the sectional then?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members should have the sectional summary for version /D. It's several pages long. At the end, you'll find a summary of repealers. As we phase out credits, there are quite a few sections of statute being repealed that relate to different credits. I won't go through those, but they're there for your review. Section 1 of the bill requires that the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission verify the beginning of regular production of new oil. This is for the purposes of starting the clock on that 10-year limit on the GVR benefit for new oil. Sections 2 through 6 are conforming to the Section 50 repeal of AS 4109, which is an old Department of Natural Resources Exploration Credit Program. Section 7 is conforming to Section 9, which relates to the disclosure of some taxpayer information. Section 8 is the section which increases the interest rate on delinquent taxes to 5 points above the Federal Reserve District rate, and also makes the move from simple interest to compounded quarterly. In Section 9 requires the Department of Revenue to make public each year the name of a company receiving refunded credits from the state and the total amount of tax certificates that are purchased from that company. Section 10 relates to the gas storage facility tax credit. This is in our income tax section of statute. So the bill provides that the Department of Revenue no longer uses the oil and gas tax credit fund to refund the gas storage facility credits. It does make sure that the new definition of outstanding liability to the state applies for purposes of refunds by the Department of Revenue for this credit. Section 11 does the same thing for the liquefied natural gas storage facility credit. And Section 12 does the same thing for the qualified in-state oil refinery infrastructure credit. Section 13 ensures that the tax that the state assesses on private landowner royalties is never less than zero. Section 14 is conforming to that Section 50 repeal of DNR credit programs in AS 3805-180I and in AS 4109. Section 15 is a key section in the bill, and this relates to the net operating loss credit. So under Section 15, the 35% net operating loss credit on the North Slope ends at the end of 2016, except for the three-year transitionary period in which the 35% credit remains refundable through 2019 for companies that produce less than 15,000 barrels of oil per day in 2016, and for companies that may not have production yet but that are operating under a unit plan of development or a plan of exploration approved by the Department of Natural Resources. For Cook Inlet, the 25% and Middle Earth, the 25% net operating loss remains at 25% through 2016. Through 2017, and then terminates. If you're going to receive this credit in Cook Inlet in 2017, a company has to have regular production of oil or gas in Cook Inlet in 2016. There's also a provision in this section that says that the application of that gross value reduction for new oil cannot increase the size of a net operating loss. Section 16 conforms to the Section 50 repeal of the qualified capital expenditure credit. Section 17 also conforms to the repeal of the qualified capital expenditure credit. Section 18 is the well lease expenditure credit. In this instance, the credit remains at 40% through 2016, and this, of course, is only applicable to Cook Inlet and Middle Earth. In calendar years 2017 and 2018, the credit is reduced to 20%. And again, to receive this credit in Cook Inlet in 2017 or in 2018, you have to have had regular production in Cook Inlet in 2016. Section 19 conforms to the repeal of the qualified capital expenditure credit. Section 20, we talked a little bit about the GVR having a time limit for new oil and then also addressing how that new oil is treated once it is no longer new oil and becomes normal oil. So this section ensures that companies receive the other new oil benefit of a $5 per barrel credit only during that time that they're receiving the 10-year gross value reduction on new oil. Section 21 further clarifies that once new oil is no longer eligible for your new oil benefits and is being taxed as normal oil, that oil is also eligible for the sliding scale per barrel credit that all other new oil, is eligible for. Section 22 is the extension of the Middle Earth credit for work in the Copper River Basin through the end of 2016. Section 33 is conforming to the future repeal in 2020 of 4355023, which are the tax credits. Section 24 conforms to the Section 50 repeal of two credit statutes that expire in 2016. Section 25 removes the authority to use the oil and gas tax credit fund to pay the refunds for those income tax credits related to the in-state refinery and LNG storage facility. Section 26 is effective in 2020, and it conforms also to the repeal of 023 credits. Section 27 limits the maximum state repurchase of credits to $75 million per company per year. It also requires that the Department of Revenue, before they go and purchase credit certificates, finds that the application is not the artificial division of what should be a single entity into multiple entities that would reasonably have been expected to apply for the credit as a single entity. Section 28 conforms to the 2020 repeal of the 023 credits. Section 29 requires that the Department of Revenue adopt regulations that grant that preference in credit refunds to companies with at least 80% Alaska hire in case there's not enough money in that fund to cover all applicants in a given year. Section 30 relates to the outstanding liability to the state and essentially says that when someone comes to have to get a refund on a credit from the Department of Revenue, the department can withhold the amount of an outstanding liability to any entity in the state from that refund. The department can use that withholding to satisfy a liability so long as the liability is not being contested through an existing appeal or adjudicatory process already established in law, unless they have the taxpayer's consent. Section 31 is conforming to the qualified capital expenditure credit repeal. Section 32 is effective in 2019 and is conforming to the repeal in 2019 of the well lease expenditure credit. Section 33 is conforming to the repeal of the net operating loss credit in 2020. Section 34 conforms to the qualified capital expenditure credit repeal. So does Section 35 and 36. Section 37 conforms to the repeal of the net operating loss credit in 2020. Section 38 requires that when you're calculating a carry forward annual loss, any reduction that's due to that gross value reduction for new oil is added back into the tax calculation so that your loss does not become bigger than it actually is. Section 39 is conforming to the 2020 repeal of the net operating loss credit. Sections 40 and 41 go to the gross value reductions for new oil. And again, this is a lifetime benefit in current statute that is being reduced to a 10-year benefit once the 10-year benefit clock starts now, once your regular production starts from a lease or a property. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission will determine when regular production begins. For any new oil that's already receiving the GVR, if this bill passes, the benefit would terminate January 1st, 2016. Section 42 goes to lease expenditures. Thank you. So it essentially says that in defining lease expenditures will now include those that were incurred in a prior year that could not be previously deducted in determining your taxes and were not the basis of a credit received. This section allows lease expenditures to carry over from a prior year. Section 43 is conforming to the repeal of the qualified capital expenditure credit, as is Section 44. Section 45 conforms to the 023 credits repeal in 2020. Section 46 is the section related to municipal producers and requires that allocation of lease expenditures and tax credits between taxable and exempt production. Section 47 adds a new definition for regular production into the oil and gas production tax statute, and it defines regular production as it is defined in the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission statutes. Section 48 is the section relating to the surety bond. Section 49 provides a new definition for outstanding liability to the state. Section 50, 51, and 52 are all repealers. Section 50 repeals multiple sections of statute in January 1, 2017, including those old DNR exploration credit programs and the qualified capital expenditure credit, and to pre-2010 tax statutes. Section 51 on January 1st, 2019 repeals the well lease expenditure credit. Section 52 on January 1st, 2020 repeals all other remaining credits, the net operating loss credit in particular. Section 53 creates the legislative working group to develop a comprehensive tax regime for oil and gas in Cook Inlet and Middle Earth, to take effect January 1st, 2019, after the phase out in 2 years of the remaining credits. The working group's proposal is to be presented to the legislature in the 2017 regular session, and it goes through some of the things that this legislative working group's proposal should include, in particular, evaluation of incentives other than direct monetary support, potentially including loan guarantees or other financing support mechanisms. Section 54 is applicability language. Section 55 is transition language related to the qualified capital expenditure repeal. 56 is transition language related to the well lease expenditure credit repeal. Section 57 is transition language related to the repeal of the carry forward annual loss credit. Section 58 is transition language related to credits. Section 59 is transition language related to lease expenditures and to the repeal of the two pre-2010 tax statutes. Section 60 is transition language related to exploration and seismic expenditures. Section 61 authorizes the Department of Revenue, Natural Resources, Commerce, and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to adopt regulations. Section 62 authorizes Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources to adopt retroactive regulations. Section 63 puts in an immediate effective date for the extension of the Middle Earth Credit, the Legislative Working Group, and the authority to adopt regulations and retroactive regulations. Section 64 sets a January 1st, 2019 effective date for several sections. Section 65 sets a January 1st, 2020 effective date for a number of sections. And then Section 66 has a January 1st, 2017 effective date for all other sections.
Any questions? Okay, seeing none, we were going to take a brief at ease while we set up the projector for our next projector. We'll bring the meeting back to order. Online we have Janet Mayer with a presentation, assisted by trustee staff to push the button. So, Janet, are you online?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am.
Can you just kind of say a few things so we make sure we can hear you? I'm not sure the volume's up loud enough.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Let me know if you're able to hear me now.
Is that as loud as we can get it?
Can you turn it up in the speaker?
Let's give it a go and see what happens. If we can't hear you, we may have to reconfigure and turn our mics off or something to avoid feedback. But, Janet, would you go ahead?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Janet Mayer. I am chairman of Analytica. We are the legislative consultants on matters of oil and gas, particularly
Janet, stand by. We need to do something here.
Okay.
If we turn these mics down or off? So if you at least mine or turn them away. Okay. I'm sorry, we're still on the record, so brief at ease. Janet, let's try it again.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me better now?
I guess it's going to have to do.
Okay. For the record, my name is Janet Mayer. I am chairman of Analytica. We are the legislative consultants on matters of oil and gas, particularly fiscal terms, oil and gas taxation, as well as natural gas commercialization and aka LNG. The brief presentation that I have to give today, the core of it is a sort of summary of the core issues here with the new proposed committee substitute. That summary goes over three slides. The first to look at areas of difference between the committee substitute that was passed out of House Finance Committee and this work draft here. And then the final slide looks at areas where there essentially is commonality between the two. Finally, the remaining slides simply provide some additional analysis on a couple of key issues. So to begin with, on slide two, obviously, the core focus and impact of this bill is around the question of refunded tax credits. Credits that in the current fiscal year, will be costing the state in FY 2016 about $500 million, with substantially more than that in FY 2015, and will again be more in 2017, and that are a fairly staggering amount of money compared to the relatively small amount of money that the overall oil and gas fiscal system brings in at these low prices. And this is clearly a bill that aims to steadily reduce that amount over time and eventually by 2019-2020 completely eliminate those refundable tax credits. As we've said in testimony on numerous occasions in the past, there is substantial difference in what those credits are and how they work between the Cook Inlet and the North Slope. On the Cook Inlet, these are credits that are really about sort of incentivizing activity in what is already a low and very attractive fiscal regime. where there is no production tax on oil and only a low fixed gross amount on gas. So when we look, for instance, at what this proposes in Cook Inlet, we're talking about a steady ramp down from the current situation to essentially no credits by 2019. Crucially, though, the bill holds the existing credit system in place through until the end of the year. That's important because numerous companies have entered into solid contracts between now and the end of the year for work programs, for in particular for drilling and other capital works, premised on the basis of receiving these credits. There are numerous companies for whom, in fact, not receiving these credits for that work to be performed between now and the end of the year could even be a question of fundamental financial viability and that even questions of bankruptcy. So maintaining those in place and allowing that work to be honoured through until the end of the year, I think, is crucial. Beyond that point, though, it takes an aggressive approach to ramping down and eventually cutting off the credits, but I think it does so with a time frame that is fairly thoughtfully calibrated in terms of understanding what's required for some of the new companies in particular that are most financially vulnerable here to complete the capital programs they need to complete in order to reach a point of enabling themselves to be cash self-sustaining. So it's an aggressive reduction, particularly compared to what's previously been proposed, for instance, in the House Finance Committee substitute, which was a gentle reduction and not ultimately an elimination, but one that I think has been well thought through in terms of being as aggressive as possible and eventually getting to zero while still allowing those companies that have been relying on those credits to complete the work they need to get to a point of cash self-sustaining moving forward. When we come to the North Slope side of things, once again, it's about ending refunded credits. On the North Slope, really, there is only one major refundable credit left in the system. There have been others in the past, for instance, the capital credit that existed under ACES, the small producer tax credit that has been cut off to new entrants this year and has a sort of tail over the next couple of years as it fades away. But there is one major refundable credit left in the system at the moment, and that is the net operating loss tax credit. As we've said in the past, unlike other credits, the core point of the net operating loss credit is simply to enable producers to recover costs that they incur that they don't have tax liability for in the year in which they incur those costs. Now, that could be for a number of reasons. In typical oil price environments, that's because a company is a relatively new developer, is incurring major expenses to develop a new project that has little to no tax liability to deduct that against. In the current price environment, though, we have a situation where even major producers, because of very low prices and substantial ongoing reinvestment, have expenses they can't deduct. Under the current system, those with more than 50,000 barrels a day take this credit but have to claim it in the future against the liability, while those under the 50,000 barrel a day mark can take this as a refunded tax credit and get cash. Now, that ability to, in some way or another, deduct all of one's expenses, whether those are expenses incurred in this year that are covered less than the amount of tax liability that you have, or expenses that exceed that tax liability, the ability to deduct expenses is the defining feature of any net profit tax, right? And under a gross tax system, you don't consider or deduct expenses. Under a net tax system, you do. What you're taxing is the profit at the end after you've subtracted out the expenses. And so, precisely because, you know, oil and gas is in many industries, investment and subsequent revenue occur at different times in the cycle, it's always absolutely crucial to say all of your expenses, whether you can deduct them in this year or in other years, will eventually be deducted. The vast majority of oil and gas tax systems do that by saying anything you couldn't deduct in this year, you can simply carry forward. Alaska has always been somewhat unique in instead of sort of simply carrying forward expenses to deduct in future years by issuing this net operating loss tax credit for companies with more than 6,000 barrels a day, it performs a very similar role to simply carrying forward an expense to deduction in the future, while it's had the unique sort of feature for smaller companies of saying instead of deducting that in the future, you can take that benefit in cash right now, and that has enhanced project economics and reduced the amount of working capital that or the amount of capital that they need to pursue various projects, and while that was affordable for the state, that had numerous benefits. But it's always been a peculiarity in some ways of Alaska's system. The overwhelming majority of oil and gas fiscal systems simply deal with this by carrying those expenses forward. What this bill would do is essentially move in that direction, to say that from 2017 onwards, for anyone with more than 15,000 barrels a day, there is no more net operating loss credit, and instead, any expenses that you have that you couldn't deduct in the current year, you simply carry forward. Now, for those larger producers who then carry forward, there is one substantial impact of that, which is that because all of this occurs sort of above the line, so to speak, in tax terms, because there is no longer a tax credit calculated after one's tax liability is calculated, there's no longer an ability to reduce the amount of tax you pay below the gross minimum floor. So for future years, for future losses, this essentially has the effect of sort of hardening that gross minimum floor against future losses. But there's a number of key differences in the way that happens here versus the way that would have happened, for instance, through the governor's original bill that simply said the 4% or hard floor, or in the case of that bill, an elevated 5% hard floor, is completely hardened, and the net operating loss and other credits can't take you below. First of all, a number of other things, for instance, for new production, the $5 barrel credit, in particular, the small producer credits and those other things are not changed by this, and so the economics of new production are substantially less impacted. But more important than that, so the impact of immediately hardening the floor, as had been proposed, would be to say to companies who have, for instance, had incurred expenses last year that they were not able to deduct and hold net operating loss credits for future deduction, and for companies undertaking work this year for which they're earning net operating loss credits because they're spending money in excess of their revenues, reinvesting while times are very difficult. The impact of hardening the floor immediately would be to say all of those credits that you assumed that you were going to have when you made the decision to undertake that work, those can no longer be claimed for as long as we're in this low-price environment, and will simply have to be claimed at some point in the future. And that's a substantial change in the sort of terms of investment for a company that had made decisions on that basis. This approach is quite different because it says to companies, the net operating loss credits that you earned in previous years, the net operating loss credits that you are earning this year, you continue to have those and will continue to be able to deduct those against your tax liability over the next several years, and that can continue to reduce your tax liability for those next couple of years below the 4% growth floor. Going forward, though, for new expenses, effectively that 4% floor is hard against those new expenses. And so by the time, for instance, when one looks at a fiscal note, when we get out to the later years, 2019, 2020, and beyond, the impact starts to look very similar to floor hardening, but in intermediate times, it'll sort of graduate and move toward that harder floor regime because credits that have already been incurred, because companies made decisions understanding that they would receive the net operating loss credit, that isn't suddenly changed underneath companies the way it would be by immediate floor hardening. I think that's a key difference that means that in terms of how the regime is perceived from a stability perspective, what companies making these decisions can live with, this might be an entirely viable way to achieve that end in a way that the pure floor hardening, I think, poses many, many more problems. Finally, as Carrie...
Janik, we have a question. Representative Tuck?
I'm having a hard time hearing. So can we, just as a matter of suggestion, can we just...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I can't hear very well at all.
I just heard my mic. Hang on just a sec. We're still having some trouble hearing you, Janik. Is there anything we can do?
Can we turn the mics down? And you still can't turn it up?
Well, let's turn it up until it rings.
And what's causing the ring if it's not the microphones?
That's my feedback. It's mine still on. Janet, can you go ahead and start again, see if we can hear you any better?
Mr. Chair, certainly. Would you like me to start again from the beginning of that summary or from all the way through? Or?
Let's go ahead and plow through, and if we have any additional questions, we'll come back to you. So continue.
So in terms of the switch to a loss carry forward system has the effect of hardening the floor against future losses while not changing the fundamental treatment of net operating loss credits that have been earned so far. And I think that's the fundamental distinction that needs to be understood. For as a transitional measure for companies that are deeply affected by any move from refunded credits to a system of loss carry-forwards, for a period between now and the end of 2019 on the North Slope, some form of refundable credits will continue to still be given. So the refundable net operating loss will continue to exist solely for companies with less than 15,000 barrels a day production or with approved plans of development or exploration. So essentially the smallest of the new producers and explorers and developers. For between now and the end of 2019, for those companies, the refundable net operating loss credit will continue to exist, but will be capped at the maximum of $75 million per company. So this clearly is on the one hand very effective in between now and the end of 2019, steadily reducing and eventually completely eliminating the state's liability on the refundable tax credit front. The key thing that needs to be understood is, of course, for many of those companies, there may have to be some very difficult decisions made. As I've given testimony before, and as I'll talk through again in a little more detail shortly, the refundable credit is something that enables many smaller companies to undertake substantial work. In some cases, new projects of $1 billion and more in capital expenditure, and to do that with substantially less total capital than they would otherwise have required, and that enables them to achieve internal rates of return that are attractive to outside financing groups, like, for instance, private equity firms, in a way that might not otherwise be the case. And so to the extent that this changes that and changes that dramatically, a number of companies are going to have some difficult decisions to make about whether they can continue the work programs that they had banked on and anticipated, whether there are ways in which they can restructure to enable them to continue, for instance, by bringing in larger or better capitalized partners, finding other working interest owners to share the burden with them, or whether they actually need to very substantially change their work program. In that sense, this refundable net operating loss credit on the North Slope has enabled an entire sort of class of much smaller companies and players to be present and do work on the North Slope, and taking that away, even in a graduated way over time, is going to have some substantial impacts, and it's important that everyone understands that and thinks through that trade-off and how they want that trade-off to be made. To continue on to slide 3, another area of difference between the House Finance CS versus this work draft is time limit on the gross value reduction. At the moment, of course, there is no time limit on how long new developments benefit from the gross value reduction. The House Finance Committee substitute would have allowed the benefit of the gross value reduction only for 5 years from first production. Now, that effectively eliminates a vast amount of the benefit of the gross value reduction, because for the first 5 years of production, for most cases for a new development, you have substantial ongoing drilling expenses throughout those first 5 years that mean you have relatively little tax liability, if any, in that time period anyway. And so the gross value reduction applied for those first 5 years has relatively little effect. What we've testified, and we'll talk about this in a teeny bit more detail on a subsequent slide, is that a 10-year horizon, for instance, allows much more of the benefit of the gross value reduction to be retained. 15 years would allow almost all of the benefit, but 10 years allows at least a substantial portion of the benefit of the gross value reduction to be retained. And so this bill takes that sort of minimum amount of 10 years to say the gross value reduction should And over time, a new oil should, as I say, graduate to old oil, but it should happen at a point in time when some substantial part of the intended purpose of the gross value reduction of that benefit has been able to be realized. On middle earth tax credits, the difference is similar between the House Finance Committee substitute and this version, in as far as it's a steeper cutoff and eventually a full elimination of credits, as opposed to a gentler cutoff and not an eventual elimination. And that applies to all middle earth credits with the exception of one specific exploration credit that is would otherwise sunset July 1, 2016, but is extended to allow for completion of wells spotted before 1st of July. Interest due on delinquent taxes, the House Finance Committee substitute said plus 5% compounded quarterly for 3 years, but then simple interest after that point. That gets enormously complex when you think about the fact that we have Fed plus 3% compounded, uncompounded at the moment. We're already changing, and then there's a question of how that change is applied when you add a third sort of a second change into the system that says for some period of time it's one system, but then another. It gets very difficult to figure out how exactly this should work. This is going with a much simpler approach of saying there is one change, which is to 5% compounded quarterly. Alaska Higher, as Ms. Delbridge's summary said, essentially this simply creates a preference for Alaska Higher, not through sort of the amount of refunded credits, as for instance the governor of the original bill would have, but simply by placing companies with more than 80% Alaska Higher higher in the queue for refundable credit payments. In addition, it adds one item that hasn't been in previous versions of the bill, which is to say that the gross tax that exists on private royalties can't go below zero. And then, if we move to slide 4, a number of things that are consistent, by and large, with changes also made in the House Finance Committee substitute. So, for instance, the ability to withhold liabilities from refundable credit payments, and this committee substitute simply clarifies that a company has to dispute a liability in order for withholding not to be used to settle that liability. On the specific Middle Earth Exploration Credit, the 025A6 credit, this simply specifies that it has to be in a Copper River Basin. And again, as discussed, we have sort of things we've seen in the previous versions of the bill, such as the credits and deductions from municipal production can only be claimed in proportion to taxable production. So for munis that own production and use for their own purposes, and the introduction, of course, of the surety bond that, again, has been seen in previous versions of the bill. Mr. Chair, if there are no questions on that summary, I will proceed and quickly go through the next few slides.
Go ahead, Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, to put this into just a bit of context on slide 5, we simply sort of showing a slide we've shown a number of times now in terms of the context of these refunded tax credits, the amounts involved that, you know, for instance, would be more than $800 million in FY 2017. And, you know, it's an enormous amount of money relative to the state's finances as a whole at the moment. You know, under current forecasts, it would exceed $1.3 billion between FY 2016 to FY 2017. It's split fairly evenly between the North Slope and the non-North Slope, but as you can see in recent years, you know, for instance, FY 2015, non-North Slope, meaning essentially Cook Inlet, has accounted, in fact, for a substantial bulk of those credits. These are essentially what are being eliminated over time by the CS. To move on to slide 6, again, this is a point we've made a number of times, but I just wanted to reiterate it, which is that there is a huge difference when we talk about these credits between the North Slope and the Cook Inlet. In Cook Inlet, no production tax, a much smaller basin with much smaller production and only a small amount, therefore, of royalty revenues. But, you know, if we look back at FY 2015, as the slide shows, a vast amount of credit outflow, which is the light gray bars on this slide. So, you know, of the three bars, the left hand is the total for the state for FY 2015, all of the colored bars above the zero line being all the revenues that come in through the oil and gas fiscal system, the gray bars being the credit outflow in refundable tax credits of, for instance, $628 million in FY 2015. Fully 404 of that in FY 2015 was in the Cook Inlet, and as you can see from that breakout of the is represented by the two bars on the right-hand side, first the North Slope, then the Cook Inlet, based on partly on Department of Revenue numbers, partly on our estimates. It's a very, very different picture between the North Slope and the Cook Inlet, and ending the flow of outflow of credits in the Cook Inlet is clearly a particular priority in terms of, I don't think anyone can look at that situation and think that that's sustainable. On the North Slope, it's a slightly different situation, partly because when you look at those North Slope numbers, there's a much greater degree of balance still between the amount that's being spent and the amount of revenue that's coming in. And because almost all that money that's being spent is in the form, in terms of refundable credits, is in the form of the net operating loss tax credit, that really is a question of recognizing expenses and whether we do it now or whether we do that later. Through the refundable tax credit, we effectively recognize those expenses now and simply pay that amount out. The alternative is to have companies hold those expenses as things that they can deduct in future years, and that's what this bill would do. To move on to slide 7.
Hang on a second. Question from Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on slide 6, looking at the corporate income tax, it looks like, unless I'm misunderstanding this, but it looks like we collect very, very little on income taxes. I'm sorry, on corporate income taxes for the Cook Inlet. Is that correct?
Representative Chair, my understanding is that's correct. That's a function of a couple of things, partly a function of the fact that, it's a much smaller basin with much lower production. My understanding is it's also a function of other things, including the corporate structures that could be used. Alaska fundamentally levies corporate income tax on C corporations. The only companies really that have to be C corporations are companies that want to list publicly and have access to capital markets. So if you're able to be, for instance, privately held, you can use other structures like S corporations and and LLCs, for instance, that don't pay Alaska corporate income tax. And that also goes by the way to explaining what you see there.
And it just looks like to me, Mr. Chair, that it's a sliver of everything else, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Janet.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So in slides 7 through 9, we simply looked at this question of the changes on the North Slope in terms of ending refundability of the net operating loss credit and eventually ending the net operating loss credit itself on the North Slope and what that does to a new development by a developer that currently relies essentially on the net operating loss credit being refunded, and also what the impact is of the time frame over which the gross value reduction can be taken. So the chart on the bottom left that you see is simply cash flow of this sort of typical investment. What we've modeled here is a sort of 80-odd million barrel field that would produce at a peak of about 20,000 barrels a day, drilling sort of 30 wells, including both producers and injectors, over a period of 8 years, total combined capital and drilling costs of $1.3 billion. Now, what you see in the chart on the bottom left, series of colored bars, obviously, purple and light blue being drilling and capital costs, this is negative capital amounts in the early years. Light blue for the capital expenses that have to be incurred before you can do anything else, like, for instance, creating a drilling pad, basic facilities and infrastructure. Light blue is drilling that occurs after that point in time. Green, then, is the revenue that comes once this project starts coming online. And you can see there's ongoing drilling expenses for many years after this project starts bringing in revenue and even after this becomes cash flow positive. The dotted black line is the after-tax cash flow that the project receives. Red is the government take, and you can see red in this case is a positive amount from a company's perspective in the early years, and that's the impact of those refunded tax credits that we're talking about. And so, for instance, the fact that those are refunded and received as a payment by this company then also means that the cash flow that they receive is not as steeply negative as it would be if they were paying effectively the full amount of the capex of the blue bars, because that's being offset by the credit that's being received. But what you can see is, well after first production, for instance, if when you look at the first 5 years from the time in which revenue starts coming in, that's the time of those first green bars, there are substantial expenses still being incurred, that's substantial drilling costs still being incurred, and for those first 5 years, you can see there's relatively, the red bars of government take that are now negative for things like royalty, corporate income tax, and also production tax, are relatively small compared to what they are later in the picture. And that's what I mean when I say that because of all that ongoing drilling and all those ongoing costs, there's very little production tax liability in most circumstances for a project like this in the first 5 years. The bulk of the production tax liability occurs only after several years of production, and that's crucial to understanding why a 5-year gross value reduction limit is not that different in many ways to taking away the gross value reduction altogether. So, for instance, to quantify that on slide 8, we look at what that means in a range of different price environments. What this chart is showing is compared to the original economics of running this project through the status quo, the system as it exists at the moment, if you put in place a limit of any number of different years, how much of the net present value of this project is taken away by limiting the gross value reduction. So the x-axis here is number of years of limit that is being imposed, and the y-axis is how much value of the original value is effectively being taken away by making that change. So for instance, and then the colored lines are different price cases. So red is $60 a barrel, orange $70 a barrel, green 100, blue 120. So if we look at that $60 barrel case, what you can see here is, first thing is that this is, you know, a project that is pretty marginal at $60 a barrel. And effectively, almost all of the net present value that exists for this project at $60 a barrel can be attributed to the gross value reduction. And if you took that away, basically, there is no net present value left in the project. So, for instance, when I say take that away, that's essentially, of course, exactly the same thing as saying a zero-year limit for the gross value reduction. And you can see that at zero, the red line for $60 a barrel, all of the value is gone. If you allow the gross value reduction for 5 years, that's still taking away about sort of, you know, at $60 a barrel, more than 60% of the project value. So it's a very, very substantial impact by having a 5-year limit. That is less the case at higher prices, but you're still talking at higher prices of somewhere between 20 and 45% of the value of a project being taken away by going from an unlimited GVR to a 5-year GVR. It's a very, very substantial change to the system. Whereas in the 10-year case, those amounts are all much less, and in general are sort of at the 20% mark, or at higher prices, 10% or less of value that's been taken away. And that's why consistently we've said if the desire is to see a limit, a point in time where new oil incentivized under the gross value reduction becomes old oil, 10 years or above makes a lot more sense to us than 5 years does, and then 10 years, of course, is what is represented in this bill. And finally, Mr. Chair, to move on to slide 9, the important thing to understand is that ending refunding of credits has substantial impacts on the smaller companies that have relied on these to this point in time. Refunded credits have enabled, as I say, an entire sort of suite of smaller companies that might not otherwise have the balance sheets and the resources to undertake the major investments that they've undertaken on the North Slope to do so. And ending that forces some major questions for those companies in terms of how they continue. The chart on the bottom left here looks at cumulative cash flow. So for this, again, the same modeled project, a $1.3 billion investment. So if you look at the solid black line, that comes down to sort of about minus $350 million. And what that's telling you is that for a company under this current credit system to undertake this project, they really need to have about $350 million of capital to do it. Because once they've spent that $350 million, they can get this project to a point that from that point forward, it's online, it's generating revenue, and it's cash flow self-sustaining, and can finance itself from that point forward. Eliminating the refunded credit changes that substantially, so instead a company needs more like sort of $500, $150 million to undertake a project like this. So if you think about companies that have taken sanctioning decisions, for instance, already on some of these sorts of projects, the question of can they continue with those investments without refunded credits or with only the next 3 years of credits at a $75 million cap is a difficult question. And there may be many for whom that sort of activity is only possible if they bring in another partner, for instance, and ideally another partner that can add substantial capital to this. That's particularly the case when you think about the fact that what you've also done is sort of push up effectively the sort of break-even or hurdle price for this sort of project by sort of probably around $10 or so, which is what the chart on the right does, is so that for any given IRR that one might need to achieve to satisfy investors, etc., the price level at which that occurs is correspondingly probably about $10 higher. And obviously it gets more difficult to bring in more capital when your internal rates of return and other things have deteriorated again because the refunded credit is going away. So clearly refunded credits are a very, very difficult cost for the state at the moment and need to be well under control. That's particularly the case in the Cook Inlet, where what this bill does is aggressive in a very, I think, well thought out way. On the North Slope is a very difficult trade-off that needs to be made between the impact of those refunded credits of effectively, as Mr. Chair, as you said, having to pay money and hand out cash to oil companies. On the other hand, understanding that as one goes about changing that situation, as one eliminates that refunded credit, that's going to have substantial impacts on what sort of companies can operate in this basin and from some hard choices among some of those companies as to can they continue and what would be required to enable that to occur, whether that be bringing in other partners or other things. So that completes my presentation for the moment.
Any questions? We're going to try this. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Janik, returning to slide 8, of course, the finance version is a 5-year GVR limit. The rules is 10-year. But there's been conversation in the legislature about 7. Could you tell us what, at $60 a barrel, what would be the developer's impact or what would be the project value? And then what would be a positive for the state if it was at a 7-year GVR limit?
So you can read from that chart that a 7-year time limit effectively would still wipe out about sort of 45% of current project value at a $60 level. That's a very substantial impact. And I mean, you know, from the state's perspective, it seems to me the key purpose, bearing in mind that only a very small portion of North Slope oil qualifies for the gross value reduction at the moment, the key purpose here, right, is to say what we're worried about is that eventually over time more and more oil, if there is no limit, more and more oil will become under the rubric of the gross value reduction. In that context, whether it's 7 years or 10 years, it's not clear to me that that is quite so crucial from the state's perspective, right, as long as there is a limit that says at some point you graduate and become old oil, so more and more is cumulatively becoming new oil over time. Whereas, while it's not a major difference, it seems to me, from the state's interest perspective, it is a major difference in terms of the impact of on a new investment and what the original purpose of the gross value reduction was. And that's been the reason that we have said so far that if a limit's going to put in place, we really think it 10 years is the sort of responsible minimum amount.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick clarifying question before I get to my other questions. I just wanted to confirm slide 9 is supposing the same hypothetical project that's outlined in, I guess it's slide 7. Is that accurate?
Representative Preston, Chair, I only heard glimpses of that. I'm afraid I didn't hear the question at all. Oh, you're asking is slide 9 refers to the outcomes of the project outlined on slide 7? Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions, both of which relate to GVR-eligible oil. And the first is just for sort of context. Say, next year, how many barrels of GVR-eligible oil are projected to be produced, and what's the effective value and reduced tax liability for that GVR-eligible oil? And my other question is, especially looking at slide 8, and you see the market difference in different price environments for GVR and the GVR limit on project value, whether there's been any thought or conversation to tying GVR eligibility to certain price environments so that GVR is triggered when oil is at a certain price, but maybe is not triggered when oil reaches a certain price, because clearly in high price environments, GVR eligibility is maybe not that vital to project viability.
Representative Cresson, through the chair, I'll do my best to answer those two, understanding that it's a digital connection. I think I heard most of the points of substance. If I missed anything, forgive me. On the first point of how much GVR oil is forecast for next year, I don't have the exact numbers at the moment, and a general Department of Revenue can give you much more accurate numbers on that than I can. Certainly, it's sort of in the single digits in terms of the percentage of the overall North Slope, but exactly what Department of Revenue forecasts, they would be in a better position to provide than I can. In terms of tying it to the GVR benefit to the oil price, I think the main thing I would say to that is Alaska's oil and gas production tax system sort of started out with a few sort of fairly simple ideas back in 2006 and has steadily got more and more and more complex over the years. Trying to take a benefit like this, particularly given that there are sort of key other things that depend on it, such as, you know, if you're eligible for the gross value reduction, also determines whether you're eligible for a fixed 5 versus a sliding $0 to $8 credit. Seems to me likely only to add substantially more complexity, which both creates a lot of instability for the companies involved, right? A key part of all of this is to say to any company that as much as possible at the time you make a final investment decision, you can nail down and know as much as you can. Okay, you have certain exposures that you can't change, like commodity price environment. But to the extent that we can make things as certain for you as possible, we want to do that to enable you to accurately evaluate your economics and know what you're getting into. And so to the extent that you sort of make benefits like this contingent on the oil price environment seems to me adds a lot of complexity, doesn't necessarily provide a huge amount of benefit to the state in the broader context, but also adds sort of instability into the system as well.
Any other questions for Janik? Janik, I've got a couple. On the investment of the small companies, is it normal for smaller companies to have partners, or is it more unusual for them to be going it alone?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. It's very usual for small companies to have partners. In lots of ways, it would be very reasonable to say that the credit system on the North Slope has enabled small companies to come up here and do some of this work that in most basins they wouldn't be capable of doing, because Alaska is pretty unique in having some of these sorts of credits. In many places, the way that small companies like this would be able to do that work is by bringing in partners. I think it's quite reasonable to think that some of this work, you know, to some extent, credits have enabled companies to do some of this work without needing to bring in partners, and that eliminating the refundability forces that difficult question and that difficult choice in terms of, you know, what can companies do now to have substantially greater access to capital, and bringing in a working interest partner is an obvious solution to that. The sort of counter side to that is to say, are there reasons that in recent years it's been difficult to get as many independent companies into Alaska as we might have liked? Obviously it's a very expensive, the North Slope is a very expensive place to invest and to produce. There's been a lot of instability in the fiscal system, a lot of reasons why this hasn't necessarily been a place, despite its enormous resource potential, that's attracted as many independent players as one might like, and that the credits have played a huge role in that. And so the question is, have we now got to a place where some of these companies that were brought in because, in part, of the credits that enable them to do these things, can they get partners? Can they still make that work? There will be cases where they can. There will be cases where they can't. I don't think anyone has a completely firm answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you. The other question I have is on the hardening of the floor. Can you tell me what impact that has on the industry and the state? And it's certainly a tax increase. And can you tell me what kind of impact that will have on the companies?
Mr. Chair, you're right, particularly in future years of the full sort of impact of the sort of implicit hardening of the floor that occurs by taking away the net operating loss credit and switching over to a pure expense carry forward system, that has the impact of effectively raising the floor against future years' expenses, and that is a substantial tax increase. It, on the one hand, provides a sort of basic level of protection of the amount of revenue the state receives should we have an extended period of low prices. It also, of course, creates a corresponding liability, if you will, that says, in the same way as the pure hardening the floor would mean that should prices stay low for a long period of time and companies' expenses not adjust, you could have mounting net operating loss credits. And you've seen that in some of the fiscal notes that the Department of Revenue has handed out previously. In the same way, under this system, you would have sort of mounting expenses. One of the things that's important to understand, is because those expenses are an above the line rather than below the line amount, when you see them in credit terms, they are one amount of money. When you see them as expenses, they're about almost three times as much because, of course, the question of multiplying versus or dividing by 35% as the amount of the credits, those two amounts are effectively the same thing, right? Above the line, they look almost three times greater because they're not being multiplied by 35%, but in terms of a sort of ongoing liability that effectively, is what's being held over to be claimed against companies' future tax liabilities, those two things are the same. But one shouldn't sort of see bigger amounts in terms of expenses being carried forward on fiscal notes and be suddenly terrified by the fact that these are three times bigger. That's simply an artifact of the fact that they're being shown as expenses to be deducted in the future rather than credits to be claimed in the future. They're still basically the same thing. In terms of the impact on companies, we've already seen the companies are paying effective tax rates at the moment in Alaska sort of at current prices, at or above 100%. Obviously, hardening the floor makes life that much more difficult if we have an ongoing low price environment for those companies. The key difference here is that Europe 1 is at least allowing the credits that have been earned so far through work last year, through work being undertaken this year, that companies have already factored into all of their planning in making those investments, that those can still be taken and be taken, including against the floor. And that sort of more gradual imposition of the harder floor, I think, is crucial in creating something that, on the one hand, provides some of the revenue certainty for the next couple of years that the state wants if we have an extended ongoing period of low prices, while doing that in a way that doesn't fundamentally disrupt things for companies the way that pure floor hardening might have.
Any questions? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't mind slowing down a little bit, Janet, because it's really hard for me to follow you, if you just don't mind just slowing down your speech a little bit. And I'm looking at slide two, and I'm guessing that We're referring to hardening the floor with the net operating loss credits. Is that the only way we're doing it, or is there another way that the floor is being hardened?
Representative, through the chair, yes. While this bill doesn't explicitly harden the floor the way others have done, it has the implicit effects of doing so by ending the net operating loss credit and shifting instead to a system of carrying forward expenses. Because those expenses are carried forward above the line, as it were, there is no credit anymore that can take you down below the floor, and so for legacy production, that means that when we look solely for the point forward at future expenses and what those future expenses can do for companies, they can't take them below the gross minimum floor anymore. The only thing for legacy production that could take those companies below the floor is net operating loss credits that they have already incurred before the end of 2016 that they can continue to claim against their gross minimum tax liability in the future if we stay in that gross minimum tax world. And once those have worked their way through the system, the floor is at that point effectively for legacy production completely hard. That's slightly different for new production, where, you know, things like, for instance, small producer tax credits and other things that remain in the system could still reduce liability for new producers and for new production below the floor amount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it sounds like to me that there's a hardening of the floor for any net operating losses that by canceling the net operating losses for any producer over 15,000 barrels per day, but there's still a soft floor or not a floor for those that are less than 15,000 barrels per day. And I'm just trying to figure out on those net operating loss credits. I'm trying to find out where we were on how far the legacy wells can continue taking those net operating losses. Apparently, they can still do the ones that they have now. How far does that carry forward? In other words,
I'm not sure I've understood your question, so let me double check. So for legacy producers, net operating loss credits they have earned up until the end of 2016, when those credits effectively stop, there won't be any more credits after that point in time. The credits they've earned up until 2016 they've earned and can be taken against such tax liability as they have for the next several years, depending on what that tax liability is. And eventually they will work their way out through the system. So no more credits will be earned, but there will be some that they have that they're limited in how much they can take simply by having a low tax liability at the gross minimum floor if we stay in this low price environment. But once those net operating loss credits have worked their way through the system, they're done and are completely eliminated.
But maybe, Mr. Chair. So the forecast, possible forecast of before it gets out of the system could be 2020, 2021, 2024, somewhere out there. Is that something we can determine?
Representative, talking to the chair, you're asking about sort of what point in time effectively those credits will be eliminated and the floor will be fully hard at that point. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, with the net operating losses. Thank you.
Representative, talking to the chair, the specifics of that, I think you need to get to from Department of Revenue in terms of their modeling, because they have, you know, their sort of full individual taxpayer-based model. We don't have access to that sort of individual taxpayer data. From previous sort of fiscal note drafts that I've seen, it looked to me like sort of by the 2020 time frame, the revenue difference between this and floor hardening was pretty similar, but I would want to hear more from revenue on that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Griffin Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'm the only member of the committee who's not on another committee that's heard this, maybe excepting the speaker. But I mean, looking at slide five over past expenditure payouts, And relating that to the chair's opening comments, which I related to, that in large part, Alaska's fortune has waxed and waned with oil and gas, and if oil and gas is doing well, the thinking being that the state of Alaska is doing well, and that's, you know, clearly empirically true to a certain extent. I'm really interested what the quantitative relationship between credit investment in the industry is with marginal increased production or revenue to the state of Alaska. Effectively, what's the return on investment relationship? And, you know, these are clearly large expenditures. The idea, the thinking, the motivation is that they result in greater production and greater investment. I'm interested if there's, this is a big question I realize, but if there's been analysis on the relationship between increased investment and production that's attributable to oil tax credits and subsidies and incentives and the amount that we've paid out, and what that quantitative relationship is. What is our return on investment through present, I guess would be the question.
Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, I will answer the best as I can. Again, please understand that I sort of catch maybe sort of two out of every three words here. So I'm going to do my best to interpret the question and answer it. I hope the answer I give matches the question. When I look at that slide 5, the first thing that I would stress is, again, to say Cook Inlet is very, very different to the North Slope in terms of that sort of credit outlay versus benefit to the state question. Because in the Cook Inlet, that really is a sort of pure question of state spending money to incentivize behaviors that it wants to see, right? And as far as it's not an integral part of the tax system, essentially in Cook Inlet there is no tax on oil and a very low growth tax on gas. And credits in that sense are purely a means of sort of incentivizing behaviors that in previous times the state wanted to see. What we have said so far in our analysis is when we look at the state of things in the Cook Inlet, particularly from the perspective of ongoing and additional investment in gas, which it seems to us has always been the key sort of aim of the credit program in Cook Inlet, that ongoing drilling in the mature field is highly economic under most circumstances that one can imagine, particularly when one has a sort of $6 or higher gas price. The development of new resources is fundamentally made difficult by a very limited gas demand, a very limited market to address, and that unless one can find a way of changing that, credits, you know, have some impact at the margin in terms of making almost impossible projects otherwise possibly vaguely viable, and as a result we've seen sort of one new substantial gas project in the Cook Inlet on that front, but that ultimately unless that question of market size and market access can be addressed, credits by themselves haven't gone a huge way to solving that problem, and mostly that what they've done is incentivize a lot of drilling for oil and cover a lot of costs for a lot of activity that in many ways is probably economic regardless. In that sense, in a time that, you know, this is a program that I think made a lot of sense when the overall fiscal system was bringing in up to $10 billion in annual revenue. These were small amounts of money to be talking about to try to stimulate activity in the Cook Inlet and turn that basin around. The cost of that program is much, much harder to justify, I think, in the current time, given all of those things. The North Slope, though, is a very different situation because the only substantial credit remaining is the net operating loss credit, and that really is a question of timing of cash flows, not sort of absolute amounts, right? The net operating loss credit is simply given in recognition of expenses that have been incurred that will otherwise be held over and deducted in the future against future revenue. So it's a cash outlay now in place of lower revenue in the future. By not having that now, you're solving a major sort of cash flow timing problem for the state, but that's revenue that one won't have in the future instead. So understand in that sense that the question on the North Slope about net operating loss refundable tax credits is all about timing of cash flow and the fact that the outlay and spending that money and then providing it to smaller companies now who qualify. It is really difficult from a cash perspective at the moment, but it doesn't change fundamentally the amount of revenue that the system over time itself will generate.
Additional questions? Representative Herron?
Mr. Chairman, a question to you.
Okay.
So, in FY17, nearly all the credits have already been earned, so there's going to be a significant invoice when those come due. But is this version your version? Is it your intent to get rid of them over time and then not pay credits to people that will not see production in the future?
I think that's probably generally an accurate statement. This is, to me, is, you know, we'd like to continue incentivizing companies. The question is, what can we afford? And I don't know that we can afford to continue writing checks to oil companies in this environment. I think Representative Christ Tompkins kind of hit the nail on the head. We certainly had incentives that worked in the Cook Inlet and the North Slope. Can we continue to pay those out into this price environment and with this kind of revenue shortfall that we have for the state? So generally speaking, I think that's probably an accurate statement. We certainly don't want to be paying credits to companies that are never going to pump a barrel of oil. We want to incentivize those that might. But this is what we can afford and what's out there. Any additional questions? Going once, going twice. With that, we will adjourn. The next meeting will be at 9 tomorrow. I would like, if possible, to have amendments in my office by 2 tomorrow evening, afternoon. We will take them up tomorrow, and that is a flexible. I'd like to try for that. We're going to try to take them up tomorrow in the evening session. Representative Tuck, you have a question?
Yes, just real quick. Only because I couldn't hear or understand Janik on his earlier part of the presentation, if you could make him available in case I have questions in the morning, because I'm going to go back and listen to this. I just simply couldn't hear the first part. I didn't want to slow things down.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And Ms. Delbridge will be available for anyone to ask questions of. If you don't have her number, I can get it to you. She can walk you through the bill. I think she has the contacts with the Janik for specific questions that we can get answered. So I think that is entirely reasonable. And we want to make all the resources available to everyone that needs them. So with that, it is 11:10, and we will adjourn until 9 a.m. tomorrow. The meeting's adjourned.